I get to, it's my delight to be with you this evening. As we came through all of the weather and the traffic and the construction to get here, this is my trifecta. I felt I was in Manhattan on my way here. But it's really wonderful to be here at St. David's and to offer you an interesting evening, stealing from the best sources like C.S. Lewis and the Bible and other things to talk about love. I was tempted to begin the presentation by saying, "Wove." Wove is what brings us here today. Yeah, you know who I'm referring to. Anyway, Peter Cook in The Princess Bride. So I get to offer some reflections on, or at least following someone who is a really magnificent man, C.S. Lewis, who wrote a number of books. I got to visit Oxford not too long ago and went to the Angel and the Child, or the Eagle and the Child, pub where C.S. Lewis would meet with J.R.R. Tolkien and with Dorothy Sayers, and would talk about, and a variety of other people, and they would talk about literary themes, and all three of them, C.S. Lewis, Dorothy Sayers, and J.R.R. Tolkien, agreed to write trilogies about Christian themes. Tolkien wrote The Lord of the Rings. C.S. Lewis wrote the science fiction trilogy. I hope you get a chance to read that. It's not frequently read by very many people. And Dorothy Sayers translated the comedy of Dante. And if you ever want a treat, if you've ever had to read The Inferno in high school, which a number of people have, go get Dorothy Sayers' translation of the Commedia, which is Hell and Purgatory and Heaven, and you will see a first-rate writer who has wonderful theological footnotes. She's the only person I know that quoted Teilhard de Chardin in the bottom of one of her footnotes in the Commedia. And she got about halfway through the Paradise and died. Her understudy, Barbara Reynolds, finished it. And so she liked what she saw, I guess, and checked out. So those three were good friends, were acquaintances. And C.S. Lewis, as you have read about him and have seen the film Shadowlands, came upon romantic love late in his life. And you probably saw, I think, Anthony Hopkins played the role of C.S. Lewis, how he was torn right down to the heart in this great love he had for this woman who died very soon after he married her. So as he wrote The Four Loves, C.S. Lewis, in his loosened prose, was talking about a tradition of love that we see in Christianity. So I wanted to reach back and talk about four kinds of love and add a few reflections on it in terms of writing from Christian authors and from psychology. So that's what's up tonight. So I'd like to begin with, why in the world do we love? Why do we have this reaction of need that's profound and moves our being, and that we hunger for satisfaction or perfect experiences of some things? Well, I'd like to take us back to our earliest years. And very briefly, Eric Erickson, the developmental psychologist, talked about how we go through various phases as we are children. He observed children closely and said they go through what are called psychosocial periods of development. The thing that's interesting about Erickson is that he sets up a way of talking about human beings which is very closely linked to Jungian psychology, believe it or not. We'll talk about that briefly, but Eric Erickson says, when you're born, and up to about age 1.5, the most important thing in the world to you is having your needs met. To get to have a caretaking system meet your needs, your little bundle of needs. Goo. You're cute. Because babies are cute and have new baby smell. Because, I wish you can that, you know. Do you know that there's new baby smell? They perspire differently than most babies. Well, everybody's so quiet. But babies are like that because they must draw attention from adults in order to survive. We are the most helpless of mammals. And so as we are attended to and our needs get met, something fires off deep within us that is not only the yearning for perfect caretaking, but also an image of the perfect parent. Did you know that? You get an image or a point of reference that if it isn't fulfilled, the baby gets really angry. That's that hoarse, angry crying that you get from the crib when you're out of sight for too long and they're demanding room service. That's what you hear from the baby. And the baby has a point of reference, it's implicit, called the perfect parent. Now, we yearn for perfect caretaking. That's an archetypal point of reference that gets activated in us. And what we get is our family and how they take care of us or not. And so we put together the yearning, the idealized expectation, and the actual experience we have that gets put together as trust versus mistrust. And you have to have both, because if you're completely trusting, you're gullible. If you're completely distrusting, you're cynical. But if you put the two together, by about 1.5, you transition up to something called autonomy. That is, the frustration of trust, the shadow of trust, if combined and held in tension with the original thing called the distrust, is held in connection with trust, it produces autonomy. The integration of the shadow at each stage of growth is what drives qualitative growth in human beings. This is automatic when we're little children, but it is voluntary when we get to be adolescents. So we can integrate the shadow at that point. We'll talk about what the shadow means, but that gets done, and so we're up to autonomy. At this point, we still have pulsing within us the yearning for perfect caretaking. That never goes away. And so we then direct our energies and our attention to another set of perceived conditions. And this set of perceived conditions is muscular independence. And this is when the child runs gleefully from you down the grocery store aisle, squealing with delight, playing chase. And yet, autonomy is not just about independence. Autonomy is about independence in relationship. So if you get out of sight for the child screams and runs back and grabs you by the leg. Actually, they don't want you to be away. They want you to be separate, so that you can connect to them through boundaries. And boundaries are what are produced during this time in a sense of separate self. Also, what is triggered inside us is the image of a soulmate. That is, there is someone for me who will exquisitely understand who I am and love me for who I am and understand just what I need. That's a soulmate. And did you know that actually is triggered between ages 1.5 and 3.5? It's there as a point of reference. That keeps pulsing away. And we yearn to be perfectly related to during this time. And what we get is our family relating to us, who sometimes relate pretty nicely, but sometimes run over us and sometimes don't pay attention. And so we develop conditionality in relationships called doubt and shame. Okay, and doubt and shame combine with autonomy. And it produces, at about age 3.5, initiative. Initiative is the ability to get things done. Now we're not just talking about glorious us. We're talking about effectiveness and impact. That's when we grab a crayon and head for any available wall as a canvas to express ourselves. We want to make and do and have impact. And we take these initiatives, and what we get is our family's reaction to those initiatives. And we learn guilt. That is, we learn how to restrain ourselves, and we start internalizing all this. We can internalize and restrict a little bit of our initiative. We put that together, but we still retain the yearning for perfect power, perfect success. It still pulses within us, okay? And especially success in the moment, at this point, as an individual, to express ourselves through our individual choice and decisions. That stays with us all our life. And that gets compressed. By about 5.5, a very interesting thing happens. The phenomenal world, that is the perceived role of a child, shifts once again. And it's not about making and doing. No, we've been able to put guilt into initiative enough so that we have discipline. And we have what is called industry. And that is when we head off to school at about age 5.5. And in a literate culture, we're able to acquire the tools of literacy. But a bigger thing is really going on. You see, we're leaving the family system that we grew up in, the whole system that we learned about rules and relationships and getting our needs met. All of that gets internalized as a set of assumptions or learnings and gets tested out on the playground or tested out in the new school. And we test out whether what we know and have internalized actually works or not. If we're from a functional family, there's not a lot of rude shocks. If we're from an isolated, dysfunctional family, there are some pretty rude shocks at that point. And so we yet have within us activated at that point the yearning to have perspective, meaning, something that sustains us through all of life's changes, all of life's shifts, all of life's necessary losses, like Judith Forst writes about. What is that? And so we start learning all kinds of things. And that goes on again until we get to puberty. So all I want to talk about are those first four stages. We never really lose our yearning for perfect caretaking, perfect companionship, perfect power and immediate efficacy, and perfect meaning or perspective. These things pulse inside us. And if they are directed to appropriate objects or to an object that cannot fail, we find fulfillment. The problem is, and the great problem we face as we grow up, is we skew these deep yearnings to objects that don't fulfill them. And that creates an addictive process. We need more and more and get less and less until we get enslaved to something that we think will fulfill us but ultimately disappoints us. That's our predicament as human beings. And good religion directs these deepest yearnings of the heart and soul that have been developmentally activated to an object that will not fail, object, big O, object, to God. And God is the appropriate object of our deepest yearnings for caretaking, for companionship, for power, individual power and efficacy, and for meaning. Okay, that's a real brief overview of development. And that's why we have four loves. Because we have triggered four archetypal, deep yearnings within us, which keep pulsing away and become a big problem for us if we don't find the proper object for them. So we're going to go through each one of these in turn, talking about them and talking about some of the tools that Christianity has brought to these four loves. So that's a little of the developmental background. I want to step outside a little bit and talk a little more about C.S. Lewis, too. C.S. Lewis, a wonderful man who wrote books about the Psalms, who wrote a science fiction trilogy, who wrote, of course, the one that people find most popular is the Chronicles of Narnia, wrote the Four Loves. And just as a little factoid, do you know what date C.S. Lewis died? What else was in the news on November 22nd, 1963, so that people really didn't know he had died? Huh? That's the Kennedy assassination date. That is what, pardon me? 50 years ago. How about that? And so that was when he died, on that day. So remarkably, he passed from us on that day. So just something to keep in mind. But he left a body of work that was really very wonderful, one of which was a very nice essay on four kinds of love. Now, we're going to go over each one of the four loves briefly. These four loves are traditionally talked about by scripture scholars. If you follow the Barclay series of commentators, Father Barclay, the Presbyterian Bible scholar that has a daily set of readings about the Bible. Do any of you follow that? Barclay? No? He's quite the rage. However, he does some nice comments on. He talks about four kinds of love. And so I'm drawing upon that, as well as a few other things. But I want to talk about a couple of other sets of four that are important. There are virtues that allow us to love, i.e. direct properly, these deepest yearnings of our heart and soul. So when we're starting to talk about the deepest yearnings of our heart and soul, which have to be directed properly, Now we're getting closer to how powerful love is and how relentless it is inside us. We seek it. We seek an object of that. It's a lifelong quest. So Christianity has had a response to this. It drew upon what are called the cardinal virtues, which are taught in moral theology. And they said there are four cardinal virtues. Remember those? They are prudence, temperance, fortitude, and justice. Remember that? I mean, if you ever had to, I'm sure that's on your nightstand. They were really quite frequently taught. And each one supports and directs a certain kind of deepest yearning. Prudence helps us in affection. We'll talk about that. In terms of our attachments to family, the Greek word for that is storge or storgic love, meaning that's the connection we have with what is familiar, literally. The virtue that helps us with eros is temperance, and a subpart of temperance is chastity. And chastity is a very interesting virtue, which we're going to look at today, which is not just wimpy abstinence, which is how it's sort of portrayed or made fun of. Chastity is a virtus, that is a power to be able to make distinctions and hold the tension. And it's really, really interesting. The virtue that allows us to deal with friendship and activity is fortitude, to give us courage, to give us courage to do the right thing, even when it's difficult. And finally, the one that virtue that underlies agape or justice is justice. That is giving everyone their due. And justice is an ability to see the entire system, to see the balance, and to order things correctly. And we will see that in agape is the kind of love in which we love other people the way God loves other people, who sends his rain on the just and the unjust today, you know, and is impartial. God loves, and God does love us, but God loves everyone. God's not on human terms, and agape love is the grace of God operating in us, but it's underscored by justice. Justice is a wonderful virtue that helps us get to agape love. is this making sense so far? Okay. There's a third thing that the church has been quite interested in over the centuries, and that is, what are the theaters of action for these kinds of loves when we get older? The kind of love that has to do with affection or attachment to what is familiar and provides contentment materially, that has to do with the area of material prosperity. In our commercial world, that would be money. You probably heard of the book by Richard Foster called Money, Sex, and Power. You done that one with a little study guide? I don't know how Richard Foster knows so much. He can't be that old. What is he in his 40s now? Do you know? The guy is encyclopedic. He really is. It's amazing. He's a Quaker moral theologian. And Richard Foster said, money, sex, and power are very dear to the heart of God, because no three things can bless or curse human life quite like money, sex, and power. So God takes them very seriously, and so does the church. In the early centuries, the church decided to, encourage people to engage money, sex, and power, which has to do with these loves that are firing off in us and are deep felt, by, in some ways, creating conditions that separated Christianity from pagan society. And so the early evangelical councils involved taking vows of poverty and chastity and obedience. They address money, sex, and power, the big three, Richard Foster said. He said, and that's fine. He said, you know, that helped us meditate on the meaning of how to direct and discipline and have an asceticism about these loves in our being, the first three anyway, in how we grew up, especially in these theaters of action. What Richard Foster said as a Quaker, he said, but I've been through the Reformation. He says, I'm a Quaker and I'm a lay person. He said, how do we fulfill the evangelical councils as a layperson, because money, sex, and power are still with us, they're very powerful. He said, since we don't wear special uniforms and join in religious orders, or live under a rule in a monastery, or lots of other things, but we're out in the world, instead of poverty, the virtue of simplicity is what we should practice. Instead of what we call, what they meant by celibacy when they said chastity, which took sex off the table, just took it off the table, hopefully, but took it off the table. And so instead of chastity, we have fidelity in the married state. And instead of obedience, which is, you know, putting our will under the direction of a superior, we have service, in which we make decisions at our level in terms of what truly serves our neighbor. So instead of poverty, chastity, and obedience to deal with money, sex, and power, we have the modern lay virtues of simplicity, fidelity, and service. Isn't that brilliant? That's what Foster said, and it's like, bingo, when I read it, I said, oh, that is wonderful. So all of us are called to practice that. And we'll see that the virtues, the four cardinal virtues, and the three virtues that deal with money, sex, and power, all support our approach toward love, the four loves, as we take our journey through life. So what we're going to do tonight is go through the four loves in turn and examine them. And I'd ask if you have any comments or questions as we go through this. You know, there's a 12-step group for presenters. It's called On and On and On and On. So I'm very aware of that. Yes, sir?
My question is, you said theaters of action, and you talked about material, prosperity, money being for affection.
Money, yes.
What's the corollary for the other three loves?
The other three is eros, and that has to do with chastity or sexual love.
Gotcha.
In this case, and that has to do with fidelity, the positive virtue that a layperson does, and then finally power or individual decision making, and that has to do with service. Brilliantly, Foster said that service takes care of power. Because if we actively and intentionally are at the service of others, we are correctly using action and our own decision making. Brilliant. Instead of saying, oh no, we must protect you from self-will run riot, or some other thing like they say about that. So did that address it? Yes, sir.
The friendship. I have some trouble relating that to the power of success.
Yeah.
And, okay. And to the initiative versus guilt.
Thank you.
Part of it.
And that's excellent. I was not clear about that. So let me proceed, and I hope I can address that. The way Lewis talked about these four loves. He said that affection, the first one, has to do with family connections and love that we learn in our dependency on our caretaking system and on our parents. It is blood, kinship, affection, and has to do with familiarity, even with common objects. It can be as profound as love for a country. It can be love for my couch, that I love my couch, you know, it's very comfortable. But in some sense, it's about attachment. It's about what I've grown familiar with, and that underscores family. That's affection, and we'll talk about that. Eros has to do with sexual love. Interestingly, sexual love is not talked about much in the New Testament. Marriage is, but not the drive towards sexual love. The Greek word eros, the Greek verb erein, is never used in the New Testament. It's always philine, or agapine, or storgine, all the other three, but not erein. And my personal reflection on this is that sexual desire was so feared in the ancient world. Cupid's arrows were so feared, it was that it was not considered such a good thing after all to be inflamed with desire, because you were considered possessed and overtaken, and you could do all kinds of crazy things. And so that was not the erotic love then. Lewis said his term was a man for a maid. How wonderful and charming that he says that. That is the love of a man for a maid. It is, in fact, erotic love. And he says it has to do with sexual love. And so the erotic kind of idealization of the object of our love is what eros involves. To address what you asked about friendship, friendship is the love we have because we share activity with other people. We share life with them. This is the kind of love that people settle down to in ways when they get married. And that they have in American courtship rituals. That is, we have a particular combination of friendship and eros in the way people do mate selection in this country. You go out, you hang out somewhere, you know, do you like the asparagus? Yeah, I like the asparagus. What do you think? Okay, over here, let's go see this movie. Do you like the movie? Yeah, I like the movie. Da, 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 da. Okay? And so people, through shared activities and shared sensory stimulation of sorts, begin to get a sense of who the other person is in terms of their tastes and preferences and so forth. That has something to do with friendship. What are we like to do together? This has to do with action, shared action and decision making. And there we get into the activity part that is the basis of friendship. You see, friends love each other because they esteem each other because both of them love a third thing, according to Lewis. And so if you and I both like stamp collecting, it's really about stamp collecting. Okay? And if Harry likes stamp collecting too, well, he can join us if we're mature. You know, it's really about stamp collecting. Whereas lovers are not facing a third thing, they're facing each other. And they want to get closer and closer and closer, and it moves toward possession and union. And so that has to do with exclusivity. Lovers want to find alone places and to be with each other more fully. And that's the difference in movement. So it's really about union for the sake of producing new life. The new life can be the life of the couple. It can be the life of actually generating a child or raising a child and so forth. But that's eros. Eros has an inevitability about it. It is linked strongly with the forces of life and procreation. It's different. It sort of has you. You don't just have it. Whereas friendship was considered the most noble of all the loves by Cicero. And he wrote an essay called De Amicitia. I don't know if you ever had a fiddle with Cicero. But he talked about friendship as the greatest love because it was the least biologically necessary. And so the Romans considered friendship, if you were a friend, it was very, very important. Okay, so that has to do with activity. Did we cover that a little bit? So it's about activity, doing it, movement, making decisions, living in the here and now. That has to do with what fortitude deals with and friendship deals with. It's sharing and connecting through shared activity. That's friendship. And the last, agape, Lewis defines as invincible benevolence, unconquerable goodwill that we have toward another human being. And it is agape love that we are asked to have toward our enemies. Not philia, not eros, not storge, not the other three. It is this love. Are you supposed to love someone who's going to beat you up and, you know, put yourself into harm's way? Well, perhaps if we really, really, if it's necessary and it's a moral decision, you know, we got to do it, we hopefully, God willing, we do it. But what we're asked to do is to train ourselves to move toward agape love, the ability to love other human beings the way God loves them, to love them objectively, to move from our subjective center of existence to the objective center of existence. I live not on I, but Christ lives in me. And that's agape love for everyone, everyone. And that's different. That's different. So we'll talk about these four. So let's plunge in, okay, and talk about the various kinds of love. First, you'll see that we look at the tools and we look at affection. Affection comes from connections in our early family. Affection comes from the link between mother and child. That is obviously used as a metaphor in the Bible of how God could never forget us. You know, the one attribute of God that is absolutely true and biblical, all the rest are sort of human constructions. The one that we know for sure that God has told us is an attribute of God. Guess what it is? It's presence. God is present. I am the one who is with you. I am present. God is more intimately present with you than any other being. God is closer. God is intimately. So Yahweh not only means I am who am, it means I am the one who is with you. That is presence. So if you want to be as God-like as possible in your relationships with others, cultivate being present. That's the most important gift you can give another human being. That is the height of relationship, is being as present as possible. So we learn in our family of origin that most of our emotional intelligence is learned between 0 and 6. That is, everything I need to learn about management, I learned before I went to kindergarten. And ladies, men have discovered emotional intelligence. Think about it. Men have written books now about emotion. No one's laughing. Goodness gracious. Men, guys, Goldman and others, and they're pretty good books, but guys have discovered emotional intelligence. We now know it's important. Ladies are going, oh, gee, forgive me, God, but really? Yeah. We write books about it. We certify people in it. People go, it's really amazing, you know, when guys decided it, and women are going. So, pardon me? Where have you been all this time? You know, Dante. Have you ever read what happened to Dante when he goes all the way through hell, on the way to his beloved Beatrice, and back up through purgatory, and he gets to the earthly paradise on the top of Mount Purgatory, and finally sees the vision of his beloved Beatrice. What's the first thing she does? Where were you? It is absolutely human. She just nails him. You know, and that's, yep. That's right, guys, you're in trouble, doesn't matter. So what we learn at the beginning is family connections, usually in through repetition, dependency, having our needs met consistently enough that we form ties and loyalty toward our family, toward our neighborhood, toward our country, toward our church, and our church community, and our church tradition. This is affection. This has to do with connections that are based on getting our needs met an awful lot, and then familiarity. One of the things I thought you might like to take a look at in looking at affection is to take a look at the second page of your notes called The Emotional Intelligence in Marriage, How What I Learned in My Early Family System is Transferred into My Marriage. I deal with this an awful lot in couple counseling, and this is a particular base that is used for affection, because you see, when people fall in love and get engaged, you discover the magic of another person in intimacy. When you marry someone, there's a lever that clicks on, and you experience family. At that point, what you learned in your family comes into play. And so that's why people who are living together, they're not quite getting it. They may say, you know, well, we're really getting to know each other, yeah, but you're not married. And when you get married, click, a whole other set of things, expectations and rules and how to be a human being in close range with other people, fires off. So I always tell people before they get married, you know, visit your intended families during the holidays. As much as possible, see as many people as you can. Watch who will not pass the potatoes to whom. There. That's the number on the locomotive that's going to run over you. Know that. That's what you're going to be dealing with. And so, one of the things that's important is to say, what did I learn when I was a little kid in my family about getting along, about relationships? This has to do with affection. This has to do with affection. People carry this into their marriages, into their adult relationships, and into the workplace. So, like feedback. What was it like to get feedback when you were a little kid from your parents? Was it okay to get information about how you did things from an authority figure in your family? Was that all right? Was it okay? Did you have family meetings? Were family meetings good things? Or were they not good things? Did anything get done? Did you know that directly affects people's attitudes towards meetings in the workplace when they go to work? Or celebrating successes. Did you celebrate successes? Did you have birthdays? Did you have Christmas? Did you have, you know, was it fun in your family? Or did you work all the time? You know, the way we celebrate is that we worked a little less. Or, you know, I knew somebody that had a team at work that ran a project team and did not know that when you completed a big goal, you had pizza. I mean, you did something. He says, why? Why haven't they pizza? They're doing their job. You get it done, you go on to the next thing, you know. See that? I said, no. Human beings need a little celebration, you know. And he had never had that in his family. He just had no experience with that. Or dealing with setbacks or loss, setting goals, handling change, sharing. Ooh. Plays well with others or does not play well with others. You know, siblings. You know, did you share a room? What was that like? You know, that has an awful lot of what to do with what you learn about what you bring into marriage or not, or into a committed relationship or not. And also has to do with how you approach colleagues at work. Whether you are honest, whether you think your work's going to be stolen from you, whether you think they're going to steal the credit for what you do or not. People have a lot of early experience of that one way or the other in their families. So, and so forth. I like to talk about some very basic things like asking for what you want. What was that like in your family of upbringing? Could you ask for what you wanted? Say, a glass of water because you couldn't get the cup off the shelf at the end of the day. Did the caretaking system say, sure, and hand it to you? Did they say, I work all day and all you do is bug me? You know, and then they give it and you feel, oh man, that's really expensive water, you know, emotionally. Or did they say, yeah, and then they forgot? Do you know people carry those directly into adult life, those kinds of experiences? So in the industry, when they put in a new incentive system in a company and someone says, yeah, sure, uh-huh, oh yeah, they're going to really do that. Where'd that come from? That came from an early experience of caretaking systems not delivering. Interesting. And people get those attitudes. Or you get into you're going out with your beloved and it's your birthday and they say, okay, where do you want to go tonight? Your restaurant, Chinese, Mexican food, Italian, you name it. And you say, oh, it's okay. Wherever you guys want to go, it's fine with me. No, it's your birthday. Where do you want to go? You know, you cannot get them to tell you what their favorite food is. You know why? They never got to make those choices in their family. That was never mirrored or reflected back to them. So it's absolutely dreadful for them around Christmas, around birthdays, that they have to come up with lists of what they want. They don't know what to ask for. It's painful. And the reason it's painful is they get close to a rather big hole in some of their development. Intriguing. And you're going, how could a person not know what their favorite restaurant is? Or, you know, come up with something. No, they go along. And they hide it in terms of being a really nice person who just does, you know, what everybody else does. That's what they do. That has to do with not having had mirrored back to you what your own choices are and what your preferences and the kind of clothes you like to wear or colors that you like, or that you can make choices and it be okay. You can make mistakes and it kind of be okay in your family. That's the kind of things that is under the umbrella of affection. All this builds up our ability for connection and ties with people who really do meet our emotional needs and learning how to recognize this. This can be problematic when people are choosing a mate because they may systematically pick people that do not meet their needs. There's a wonderful guy named Willard Harley. Think of a rat on a motorcycle. Willard Harley. Okay? He wrote a book called His Needs, Her Needs, which I do recommend, in which he said there are 10 needs that couples really, most people have, that are emotional needs. And couples that meet each other's emotional needs are the ones that really have stable relationships. He says, not the ones that talk all the time. No, it's the ones that really meet each other's needs. So he lists 10 needs, and he says, I want you to look at these 10 needs, pick the top five, and of the top five, I want you to rank order your top five. He has a husband and wife do it separately. Then he has them guess what their needs are, which is great fun. You get $1 for everyone right. Okay? And then, that's fun. I've done that. And then I get them to read the book because each chapter of the book is about one of the needs. And if I find out what my number one and number two needs of my spouse might be or my significant other, by golly, I'll do what old Harley says. And it's like portable therapy. It's a lot cheaper than psychotherapy. It's in a book. It's called His Needs, Her Needs. Okay? So that has to do with that kind of meeting people's needs that is the basis of affection. So one of the things that you can do that's really interesting is to go down this sheet and put down what you experienced in your early family, as you can remember it, and see how it transferred as a set of assumptions into your marriage. How does it transfer into your adult relationships? That's helpful. And make a copy of this for your significant other. Have them do it. And then sit down over your sweet tea and talk about it. It's very interesting. Just take it category by category. It's very interesting. It's a way to get to know some of those early times, you know. A lot of times it isn't you they're mad at. You've just done something that reminds them of what happened when they were younger. The part of our brain called our unconscious operates by similarity and not by time. So all adult conditions have to be as similar enough to what happened when we were little and we have all the feelings of a child kick off in us. That's where that comes from. But there's something even more mysterious. Turn to the next page, please. This is called intergenerational legacies of attitudes and feelings. Did you know that you can have attitudes and emotional reactions that are reactive to historical events, to people, to groups, that these reactions originally occurred before you were born? Do you know you have those in you as a layer of potential reaction? And you get them from your parents. You get them from your grandparents. It's not biologically handed down. It's socially handed down. Before you were 5 years old, you drank in your parents' attitudes and feelings. You didn't have any shields. And so, glug, 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 in goes all this stuff. The jokes, the silences, the references, the way people talk about things. Kids are like sponges. They just take it in and there it is. And it stays with you. And you walk around as an adult until you come into a situation that's similar enough to what went on for your parents having had that reaction. And you can have the reaction yourself and go, why am I reacting like that toward this group or toward this situation? I never had that happen to me. No, it happened to your parents. And get this, your parents had that happen to them before they were five. And they transmitted some of that down to you. So you can have reactions in 2008 to the Great Depression, which some people did have. Terror. Everything was collapsing. It was all falling apart. Or when we hear rumors of war, you can have the feelings about war. I had a reaction one time. I was reading a magazine. I saw a Japanese product and I went, ugh. And I went, where'd that come from? And so I did a thing called the genogram. That's this is all explained much too thoroughly in this thick paragraph. But that's what it's talking about, this intergenerational transmission of stuff. And you know where we found out about intergenerational transmission of attitudes and feelings? We don't get that from graduate school in psychology. We got it from our brothers and sisters in AA. They're the ones that said, oh, by the way, you know your grandfather drank and you're screwed up. Yup. That's how it happens. It's called intergenerational transmission of family dysfunction. That's how it is. Do you know what we call that in Anglo-Catholic theology? Well, back then it was the same thing. Augustine saw this going on and he said, you know, there's something really weird about the Smiths. You know, and oh, no, I'm not, nobody here is Smith, but I'm using a generic term about that family, because the parents, the kids are like the parents. I've lived long enough, said Augustine. I've seen this thing go down through the generations. He said there must be some kind of screwed upness that occurs in human beings that is intergenerational and unconscious. By the time you've handed it on to your kids, you know, by the time you wake up to the fact that you have it, you've already handed on to your kids. It's like fate. You can't stop it. Do you know where he got this idea? He did not get it from Hebrew tradition. Hebrew tradition produced the theory of actual sin, meaning you break the law and the commandments, bad, wrong, you pay. No, original sin came from Greek tragedy. Greek tragedy, where the protagonist is unaware of a tragic flaw and wreaks destruction on everything, like Oedipus to his kingdom. And he doesn't even know it. He doesn't even know he's the one. And only in the end does Oedipus get insight by blinding himself with his dead mother's brooch. Oh boy, you know. Nice Saturday night at the movies. But he does that. But that's Greek tragedy. That's why we still read those today. That's original sin, folks. Today we call it intergenerational transmission of family dysfunction. And it's just like AA. Okay, so this too, we can be loyal to certain things that are quite dysfunctional. And we need to work on having separation and individuation from the emotional flow of our family sometimes. So you need to pay attention. All of us have stuff that's intergenerational. Back to my reacting to a Japanese product. I remembered as I did the genogram, I started here and went up to mom and dad and grandparents and fill in the blanks, you know, with siblings. And I realized my dad was in Burma in World War II. Any of you are familiar with Burma in World War II? It was bad. The Japanese were ferocious adversaries. And my father, being a fair-minded man, came back, but he had some reactions to things that were Japanese. And I got it from him. I got it from him. I've never been mistreated by an Asian American person or an Asian person, but I still got it. This is what we get from prejudice. We get prejudice this way. And when people do diversity training in companies, you know, everybody comes in, they think they're pretty fair-minded. They sit down and the trainer usually lays some heavy historical stuff on the audience. And people are there going, where did that come from? I reacted to that. I don't believe that. I'm not that, am I? Do I? See, that's that historical stuff, that overlay. And so what you need to put in place is a good historical boundary. That was then, this is now. Go study that period as much as you can to try to understand what people were going through, what they understood, why that was the case. Then you can make a decision by making it conscious that I'm not going to do that. But that stuff's layered, and we've all got it. We've all got it. I remember my little sister coming up to me in the wine gardens. I'm kind of old. This is in the 50s. And she said to my mother, "Mommy, Mommy, it's not Kool-Aid." She had just been to the water fountain and it said colored. Wow. And she thought it was Kool-Aid. So it was going to be Kool-Aid. So it's all there. It was there. We got it. So it is our job to shake that stuff out. And when we encounter groups or persons or experiences or whatever that produce these reactions, our job is to go back and historically look at them because we are tied to them in a way. One of the biggest instances of this is when we have fights where nobody can back down in a family, where people are going at each other. You ever been in a fight where you keep coming to the same point and you can't back down? A lot of times that has to do with family honor and you don't know it. So I tell couples, break, stop, both of you do a family tree. Both of you do a family tree. And then I want you to discuss one, two generations up, the same content of this argument. Just see who did what in terms of this. And as the couple talk about it, they go, oh my gosh, we're fighting Uncle Hank and Aunt Tilly's fight. It's still going on between us. That happens. That happens. So those are some of the things, some of the psychological tools about affection, but it is directing the deepest yearnings of our heart for connection and dependency, healthy dependency, toward an object that cannot fail it. Okay? And keep that in mind. That's the first love when we talk about affection and families. I'd like us to skip the next handout. And the next set of notes is, we don't really have time to do this, but I wanted to give you, of course, a copy of a psychological type test. So you can take it if you wish. Some of you have not taken the Myers-Briggs Type Indicator or the Kiersey Temperament Sorter. And I use it so much that I like to use it as a way to understand the second love we're going to talk about, which is eros. Remember, we have a deep yearning for perfect companionship. In fact, complementary companionship. An ache in our being that we're not whole until we find our other half, it's called. There was a theory in the ancient world that human beings were originally great big circles, and the gods thought them too powerful. They had eight arms and eight legs, so the gods cut them in two. And they went off in different directions. And so ever since that, people have been trying to find their other half. That was an old story in the ancient world. Well, it seems like that. You see, we think, no, there's got to be this perfect person, the yearning of my heart. Can that be untrue? How could God have given that? It deep laid that on my heart, and it not be true. So one of the things I'd like you to do, you ought to do it. Come on, let's take 5 minutes and fill the test out. You ready? This will only take you 5 minutes. Okay? The way you fill it out is that you go down the page to answer the questions, and you answer the questions in the bubble columns down below. But note, the bubble columns you answer by going across the bubble columns. Notice it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 going across. Just realize that, okay? Anybody need a pen? Oh, that's always good. Good, okay. By the way, we have iced coffee over there. Boy. This is the shortest test I could find for this lecture tonight, and I did it about work because only takes 5 minutes. The other ones are much longer, and I couldn't have put them in the lecture. Sorry. Yeah, I know. Please forgive me about this. Just try to do your best on it. Okay, thanks. Good point. Yes, people do change, I think. In the first half of life, the requirement of growth is to be excellent, like Bill and Ted, and to form our preferences in our choice for companions and work. But as we get to about 37, you're not there, of course, 37 and up, we start having the other side of us knocking on the door, wanting admission. So the type indicator tests really do speak to the other side of us coming in for development. It's not like when we're younger, but it is necessary. And so there's an awkwardness that occurs. That's midlife transition.
This Richard Rohr falling up. Have you read
it? Oh yeah, Richard
falling upwards.
Yes, Richard Rohr is amazing. Yeah. I've listened to Richard Rohr tapes. I can only do it about 10 minutes at a time. He's so rich. The second half of life, the other side of you comes and knocks on the door. Like Pogo says, we have met the enemy and he is us. Only it's like the non-preferred side of us, and that's the lens, by the way, that we see people through as we deal with them. And it's very hard to see people opposite us in psychological type preference as being totally competent or with it. We tend to see them a bit prejudicially. It's really interesting. Yes.
If I have three here.
You put three and two, and that gives you three in this and two here, and you circle the three, the E, that's below the three. Okay, as people are getting their brownie and coffee and so forth, let's take a look at Eros a little bit. Eros, when I said the word, Greek word for sexual or erotic love, is not found in the New Testament. It isn't there. Why could that be? Well, one personal reflection on it is that the principal competitors for Yahweh worship in the Jewish world were fertility cults. They were, in fact, divinizing sexuality because it had everything to do with reproducing crops and livestock, which was serious business. The king and the high priestess making love in the middle of a field in view of the people so that ritually made the field productive. All that was going on, and Jews found that just to be abhorrent. That was, idolatrous and a misdirection of it. And so you hear this thunderation going on about adultery, and a lot of good sexual imagery is used. So one of the reasons that sexuality has been such a kind of electric topic, and from the earliest centuries on, not just the classical period, all the way up to today, in which I think that we're going to find the solutions to people who are gay being included in the church. We will find that in the Acts of the Apostles when we look at Gentile inclusion. Because exactly what they were saying about Gentiles in the Acts of the Apostles, they say about gay people today. And we have a model for it. It's very interesting to watch. So, no, it's not gone away, folks. It's still really scary to most people. And maybe that was one of the reasons we love, but we just don't get close to that one. We're not going to get too close. So I wanted to talk about a contribution to erotic love and sexual awareness that is a wonderful contribution. It was made by Carl Jung. And in order to do this, I needed you to take a little type test. First thing is that you will notice you got a four-letter type code, which is one of the 16 down on the bottom right. But in addition to that, we're going to get what is called a temperament. And that's what we're really after. Did you get the S or the N circled on this second pair of letters? If you got the S circled, letter number two that I want you to pay attention to is the J or the P in the fourth pair. If you got SJ, you're SJ temperament. If you got SP, you're SP temperament. Okay? If S is in fact the larger letter. If you got N instead of S as your larger letter, you get letter number two of your temperament from the third pairing, T and F. Now, this all sounds convoluted, but it works. You're either NT or NF, depending upon whether T or F is the larger letter. You got more endorsements, okay? Does everybody have what their temperament is? It's either SJ, SP, NT, or NF. Got that? Okay. Let's go to the next page and very quickly look at these four temperaments. And this is fun. Okay? This is by Don Lowry, who's a consultant, really nice guy. Let me use his cards, and I've kept using them. He said, here are characteristics of the SJ. Look at that top card. Aren't those neat people? They make up 40% of the population. Keywords: conservative, judicious, practical, dependable, sensible, parental, dutiful, serious, responsible. They value structure, stability, work, service, authority, organization, predictability, belonging, and usefulness. Wow, UNSJ's on your team. They were born adults. They fix the roof in the parish. They get the soup kitchen set up. More importantly, they take care of people. They're great caretakers. Ha! Yearning for perfect caretaking. Where did that go? Oh, that yearning for perfect caretaking has become a central motive for the SJ personality. And each one of these yearnings becomes one of the four temperaments around which our adult personality wraps, it seems. So SJs are keenly aware of the needs of others, of stability, structure, security. I don't know, says the SJ. You know, let's make sure it's okay. They're wonderful, wonderful folks. And they invent, you know, law books, history books, piggy banks, and everything else that goes with it. So those are great people. They make up 40% of the population. Okay? Look at the bottom card. That's NF. How many persons here got NF? Okay, there's the NF. Okay, look at the NFs. Good NFs. They always come to training. You know? I'm going to the church. I'm going to learn. It'll be wonderful. We will co-evolve. Look at the key words. See the love and the heart behind. Key words: communicative, empathetic, sensitive, imaginative, idealistic, romantic, spiritual, creative, searching. They value harmony, significance, possibilities, relations, authenticity, uniqueness, integrity, potential, and honesty. And guess who's looking for the perfect companion? Guess where the yearning for a perfect soulmate gets full expression, and who knows that people can really relate to each other in depth and intimacy, and that's what life's really about. And one of the strong expressions and natural expressions of that is Eros. NFs are particularly gifted in the area of sexuality. They really are. They have a lot to offer the church in the area of sexuality. We're just scratching the surface of that now. You heard it all here. You heard it here. Okay? Third is SP. How many SPs here? Anybody score? Oh, good. 1, 2, 3 SPs out of the whole group, maybe 4. SPs are great. They make up 30% of the population. Look at these. Good, neat. These are fun people. Performers, competitive, wandering, playful, impulsive, spontaneous, physical, bold, lighthearted. They value adventure, excitement, endurance, freedom, action, variety, risks, motion, fun, and enjoyment. Friendship. Friendship and the yearning for perfect action. And connecting to others through impact, success, happiness, perfect action, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's SP. That's the ethos of our culture, American culture. That's how we're viewed by the rest of the world in a lot of ways. Like this card. How would you like to have these people leading an army? You know, that's scary. That's scary. They're like, yeah, dude. Nuclear weapons? Sure. Why not? I'm not kidding. That's scary. Okay, and then finally the NTs. How many NTs here? Not very many. Judy, you an NT? Nah, you might. You know, NTs, okay. Oh, these are smart people. Look at them looking at you over their half rims, you know. Keywords: wisdom, innovative, futuristic, critical, controlling, conceptual, abstract, systematic, independent, skeptical. They value vision, power, intelligence, capabilities, skills, precision. They may be a bit distant when preoccupied. Logic, knowledge, perfection, and competency. NTs often wear their hair long. It covers their Vulcan ears. The joke is that NTs are very bright, and they always have a perspective on something, and they just have a different approach. And now for something completely different. That's the NT, okay? Agape, folks. Agape. And in fact, and now for something completely different that involves the energies of the other three loves and coordinates them and allows for objective love like God's love. And there's something, dare we say, Trinitarian in the way that all operates, that we have agape as the life of the Trinity. And that's where we're heading in learning how to love. So, yes, well, we're going to wait till the end. I'll tell you. Okay? You might see, in terms of romantic love, now Eros, on the following page after the pictures, it gives you love in the SJ, love in the NF, love in the SP, love in the NT. How people tend to have a different take on erotic or romantic love based on their temperament. Now, this is like taking all four temperaments, but really, the NF is quite sensitive to it. Okay, so sort of there. See, NFs think that, wow, romantic love is something that's going to last a lifetime. It should always be like that. You should always be that special to someone, want to look in their eyes and hold their hands and co-evolve together. And you're the gateway to my being. And so forth. That's how NFs see it. They see the exchange between people with that kind of energy, with that kind of erotic energy. So, because erotic love is something that's so strong, I want to offer the second neat thing that Jung offered, I mean, in my opinion. This is the idea of the opposite sex inside us, or the, well, inside us. In every man, there is a feminine part in his unconscious. We have recessive traits physiologically. Men have nipples, they don't nurse. But, you know, we have echoes of the opposite sex in us. We also have psychological recessive traits. That is, there are feminine parts in a man's personality that are generally in his unconscious. Okay? A woman has masculine parts physiologically, too, that are echoes of what is masculine. But she also has a psychological masculine part in her unconscious. Okay? What is the function of this opposite sex part of us? Jung said, for most people, it is to be the repository of all experiences of the opposite sex. Biologically, that means in an evolutionary sense, culturally, socially, personally. All of that goes into a great mixmaster down here inside us of the opposite sex. And out comes an image of the opposite sex on our terms. That is, that would really fulfill us. You see, for men, that's a 10. Ladies, you're not 10s. You can't be. The only 10s exist in men. And they project that onto females if when they fall in love with them. And so women are great, but they're not 10s. They're very beautiful and wonderful, but the only 10 exists in a man. In a woman, the ideal male is an RM, a real man. Now, a woman was not raised as a male, but she knows what a real man would do. A woman knows. A real man would talk back to that state trooper. You know? She knows what a real man would do. But, I mean, she just knows. And she has that point of comparison. Now, why do we do this? I'm talking about heterosexual couples. For a person that is homosexual, it is a person of the same gender. Okay, but the erotic image serves the same purpose in for both in terms of our growth. So let's take a look at this. First of all, for men and women, it gets the genders together. You tend to cross-project these idealized images of the opposite sex onto your beloved, and you see that as the gate to happiness and the gate to the rest of your life. It's like your entire future is ahead of you in this relationship that is opening up. Okay, we attribute that to the relationship. That's not untrue, actually, but it's the activation of the yearning for a soulmate that's coming back and is being attributed to this person. We fall in love. Hopefully, it's a two-way thing. We get into a committed relationship. We get into marriage. And then the projection is withdrawn bit by bit. And we go, you, I married you. Yeah, and you got a tattoo, too. Remember? Something about a tiger and Mike Tyson. I don't know what it was. But okay, so you go to whatever came over me. Well, what is the purpose of our passionate reactions toward other people, where we idealize them and want to unite to them, want to be with them, want to share time with them, make love to them? What is that purpose besides getting people together and reproducing the species? Jung said there's another purpose. We should pay very close attention to what we find ourselves sexually attracted to. Of course we will, because it's the roadmap of where we are going to grow next. How could that? He's gone round the bend now, folks. You know what do you mean? Well, meaning this, that if you run into, say you're in a committed relationship, and hey, people are beautiful. You're going to run into people that are just going to curl your hair. You know, you're going, wow, how about that? Look, woo, oh my mama, what am I going to do? You know, and so what do you do if you have a passionate reaction and you're in a committed relationship? Does it mean that, well, you're just an immoral person? No. And this especially is true for people at midlife. This gets kicked up into gear. It doesn't mean you're immoral. It doesn't mean that you should question your committed relationship necessarily. It doesn't mean that lots of other things, you know. You should take action on it. No. You should restrain it. Okay, and then sit down and immediately go to the next page of your notes. The last page? Oh, no, wait. It's the big notes. The big notes. Excuse me. The big notes that says, how our sexual attractions can map our personal growth. Okay, and you sit down and for your eyes only, you write down what are the smoking qualities of this person. I mean, man, just absolutely dazzling, wonderful, stimulating qualities of the person. And write them down, really, for your eyes only, okay? And it doesn't mean you even know this person. You're attributing all kinds of things to this. So like for me, it would be, I'll give you an example, okay? I took our children to Rollins Barber College on Burnett Road one Saturday for cheap trims for haircuts. And as we're sitting there, you know, in walks the barber student. And she is about 23 years old. She's tanned, toned, happy, carrying a jam box and singing. Da-da-da. And my heart goes bong. And I'm going, oh, no, I don't need this. For once, though, I do the drill. So I sit down. Okay, do it. You know, it happened to you, so do it. So write down, what am I attributing? What am I think she is? Fun, healthy, outdoorsy, carefree, come play volleyball at the beach, lighten up. I still remember the list. It was like that. So why do I need to get in touch with those qualities? Get the sexual metaphor. Get in touch with those qualities to have greater life. Sex is always about greater life. It could be your greater life. Not just producing a baby, your greater life. Okay? I had been writing a paper for a conference which was going to change thinking in the West as we know it. I was a little overwrought and was no fun to be around. I was a Grinch with my kids. I was not getting out of doors, was not exercising. She was the antidote. She was exactly the antidote to that. And so she was the wake-up call, but not the answer. So, what we are to do is to make the list of what it is that's so smoking about that person and then do an action plan in each one of those areas in my present life and get to work on that rather than pursue this person. That's what we are to do. Okay? Another variant of that is a guy comes in and seems, oh man, I'm so aware of this person I work with, you know. She's a woman. I never knew that before. And I'm like, oh, gee, God. You know, but he's in the thrall of it at this point. You know, and he's just, oh, I have all these daydreams. What am I going to do? I said, look, just for your eyes only and mine, and we will shred it after you bring it in, I want you to write down the fantasies, the daydreams. Okay. He writes it down, brings it in, and we go over the daydreams. You know, and it could be, oh, we take a trip, and we live in a hut, and we fish, and I'm happy, you know? I mean, it's simple. And it's really, you'd be surprised. And so, all right, okay. And let's look at this. Now, let's subtract her out of that daydream and see how many of the elements of this dream you can put into your present life and commitments. Did you know that some of the most constructive thinking you've done in years about your life, some of the most happy, constructive, positive that happens in midlife for a lot of guys, and they bounce it off of a love object, a woman. A lot of times they do that and say, let's just subtract her out, and you can bring that to your wife, to your, your family, or to the person that you're committed to. You can bring that. I can? Yeah. It's supposed to activate that in you and give you the energy to pursue it. That's erotic energy. And that occurs in a burst at midlife. Whoa, I didn't know that. Yep. So, that's, yes. What, you're just going, oi.
No. The Supreme Court case in Iowa, the Iowa Supreme Court case that was just decided, a woman who had worked for a dental assistant, he fired her after 10 years because he and his wife were worried he'd have an affair with her.
I hope he lost the case. See, and that is the prejudice. By the way, women have been taking the rap ever since the good rabbis wrote about Adam and Eve. You see, the story of Eve in the garden is much more a story of the feminine part of a man's personality than it has anything to do with a real woman. Men wrote that story. And they did. They wrote that story. And you know what gets a man into trouble? The feminine part of his personality, which is more sensuous, and he's terrified of it. Terrified of it. It's vulnerable and, suggestible. That's the man's personality. And so men have projected that onto women and attempted to control women ever since then. Put burkas on them, pass legislation, things like that. So that's very much it. Men are terrified of the part of themselves that is feminine, and they take it out on female human beings. Now, women do stuff to men, too, There's the improvement project. That you fall in love with men, and with just a little bit of love, he'll become such a good man. And, the improvement begins. Yeah. I knew you'd bring that up. What? No, what?
I love smoking, but the smoking folly is often a deficit in your own.
It is the fact that you are seeing it as just irresistibly smoking is that you need to get in touch with that vitally in order to have the rest of your life. To complete yourself. And sex is the prime metaphor for that. You see? And if we learn how to observe and journal and write, even if it's daydreams or if it's simply listing and doing an action plan, we're able to then understand the lesson. Now, try this on. Chastity is not wimpy abstinence. Chastity is the ability to relate to the feminine ideal called the anima, or soul image, that is absolutely ravishingly beautiful and that melts a man down and reconstitutes him as needed. Okay, to relate to her and to relate to actual female human beings, and particularly ones, say, you're committed to, to do them both appropriately and in the right dimension and to hold the tension. That is chastity. When we confound the two, that's when we get all kinds of mischief. And that's a failure of chastity. How interesting. What a new idea about chastity. Yeah.
So you've been talking about the person in a committed relationship who's having a thing going on over there.
Yeah, he's got an attraction.
Right.
He's had an attraction.
What about the person who's single?
Okay, a person is single. Just a couple of thoughts. One is, sometimes people are there for our growth, and we can have very strong erotic reactions toward them, and they're not candidates for a committed relationship. And that erotic attraction is about our growth It's about stuff that we should be paying attention to. Of course, we will. And we get it in a relationship with the person, but the point is to connect to it in some way for our growth. The other thing to keep in mind is this. When you're involved with someone, I always like to say, you know, a lot of the teachings about the inner child, they talk about inner child since John Bradshaw, you know, the little inner child. Okay, that's a personification of our vulnerable emotional life. Okay, and it's useful to talk about, in your case, her. Okay, people know how old their inner child is. They really do. I said, well, how old is she? And the lady says, she's about 5. You know? And she showed up with suitcases and pigtails one day. And she's mine. And I take care of her now. There's the key. We do not foist the care of our inner child on somebody else in the name of relationship. And so, when people are dating, I always tell them, I had one gal come in and says, yeah, we've been dating for a few weeks. He wants to go for a trip to the beach. I don't know. I said, how old's your inner child? What do you think? She says, oh, she's 5. She's real clear on this. I said, would you entrust the care of a 5-year-old girl to this man for a weekend at the beach? No. Well, why are you entrusting yourself to him? Immediate. Click. So one good way to take care of ourselves emotionally with people in the back and forth of dating world and all is to say, would we, you know, kids need to be protected, kids need to be taken care of, kids need not to be put in overwhelming situations. We should pay attention to a part of ourselves that's like that. So that's a good thing to keep in mind. Yeah.
This may be the subject of another presentation, but how does all this fit in with the person who's made a vow of celibacy?
I think in the early church, we are all made for marriage. All of us to unite masculine and feminine in our being in some way to learn what it means to be a complete human being. In the first half of life, this is my pitch, in the first half of life, many, if most people, unite with someone. And they experience what it's like to be at close range and to be completed. They even talk that way, that we're completed and I'm a better person because of you. That's rehearsal. We don't know that in the second half of life, we are to unite to the opposite sex inside us. That is called the sacred marriage, the hieros gamos. And it is the goal of a lot of Jungian psychotherapy. That is, to become complete as a human being. All things are united. And in that completion, where there is neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, that's Christ. That is us coming together, okay? So there's an internal marriage in the second half of life. In the early church, there were some people that witnessed to the integrity of a complete person from the very beginning, like in integrating masculine and feminine, that did not seem to need the opposite sex to live an integrated and complete life, and they lived lives of service and dedication. They were celibates. And it is a witness to human wholeness. It is a witness to that that was seen in the church, especially where sexuality was really all over the place in the pagan world at that time. Okay? Then celibacy got mandated in the church as a requirement for ordination. Probably. And it really got mandated in the Fourth Lateran Council in 1215. Okay, bam, you have to. Why? Property requirements. Because if you get married, you have children, you want to hand the parish on to your kids. And it's just a lot cleaner if you've got no kids and you don't get married. And by the way, you can completely control the people in your church. And that went on for a while up to the Reformation. Now we have married clergy and so forth, and nothing's really blown up, it seems. So I think that's one way to look at the history of celibacy. One way. We still are tangling. We're just barely scratching sexuality. And I wanted to now ask you to look at the very last one of the extra set of sheets, this one with the graph on it. The graph is the principal graph that you see in almost all sexuality textbooks. And it's the human sexual response in general that Masters and Johnson, the researchers up in the laboratory in St. Louis, that really looked at human sexual response, male and female, for years and years and compiled in a book, said, this is pretty much how most human beings react. The thing that surprised them was that even with the differences between men and women, there seemed to be four stages. Count them. Four. Interesting. Okay, there's excitement. That's, you know, all the stuff that enters into people finding each other very interesting and endearing and loving and da-da-da. Then there's plateau, which is a shift in body awareness where the whole body becomes very, very sensitive and lovers idealize each other. And that's lovemaking. And that's the plateau period. That's what sex therapists wish to elongate for couples to help them do that. There's plateau, and then after a certain point, there's a shift in the autonomic nervous system to get to a point of a feeling of inevitability, and there's a real shift in awareness away from fantasy land and idealizing the beloved to here and now, here and now, here and now, and that is orgasm, and can be insemination and pregnancy and all kinds of real, active physical stuff. And then, following that, is resolution, which is a feeling of peace, overview, relaxation for everyone but Woody Allen. And so, excitement, plateau, orgasm, refractory period. Okay? Meeting our deepest yearnings for caretaking and all the elements that go into our life, for idealization of the beloved, for doing something together that's really amazing and has tremendous vitality and force behind it, and then finally for our yearning for perspective, because there's a sense of mountaintop and there's a sense of peace and perspective and a sense of union. The sexual response in human beings, we are just beginning to appreciate, enacts the four deepest yearnings of our psyche and is a sacrament of these coming to completion with God. It's wonderful, and we haven't even looked at it as much yet as we need to. But please know that inside every human being, in terms of their sexual responsiveness, is a God-given, restoring sequence that is pleasurable and restoring and wonderful that triggers these deepest yearnings of the human heart. And that's why sexuality, I think, is so tremendously important. But I thought you'd like to see the sexy picture that is. Also, you might note that the first stage is SJ, NF, SP, and T. And if you think of the temperaments and what they represent, all those words that were described, and it's okay, the SJ is all of the elements of marriage and all of the structures. SJ is excitement. That's all the things that make up approaching each other. Then there's the idealization of the beloved in the plateau. That's the NF. Then there's action, action, action. That's the orgasm. And then comes the refractory stage, which is calming down, peace, union, and a brand new reality. Could be a pregnancy. How fascinating. So, okay, moving right along. By the way, when in Holy Communion, the fourfold shape of the Eucharist that Don Gregory Dix writes about, an Episcopal liturgist, said that from the earliest centuries of the church, it was taught Jesus took SJ, blessed NF, broke SP, and gave. And that is the Eucharist. That is the transformational sequence that we are drawn into when we go to Mass or Holy Communion. We are taken, we are blessed, we are broken, we are given. And then, it's not done yet. You ready? Remember trust versus distrust and the yearnings of the human heart? Then we hold hands and we say the Lord's Prayer and listen to the petitions of the Lord's Prayer as a developmental sequence. Trust versus distrust. Need for connection and caretaking. Give us this day our daily bread. We are directing the deepest yearnings of our being to God our Father. Yearning for perfect companionship. And forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Trespasses, boundaries, perfect relationships. And it is our yearning for God the Son who is with us in shared brokenness. Our intimate companion, Emmanuel. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. When we're in the action mode, when we're making decisions, when we have the power, oh God, protect us from ourselves, especially as the United States. Protect us from ourselves. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil we're capable of, when we can make independent choice to do that. That guides that deep yearning for power and efficacy. And the fourth, liturgically, for yours is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever. Amen. That is ultimate viewpoint of eternity and what it's really all about and where it's all leading. Isn't that amazing? We say that in the Our Father. So those four deep yearnings get triggered. Bum, 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 bum. And that is why it's the prayer we say. So when we're at church on Sunday, then we hear four Gospels drawn upon when we hear the preaching. We hear Matthew, which is S.J., Luke, N.F., Mark, S.P., and John, N.T. That is, we see a face of Jesus that our temperament can connect to, but we, in the course of a liturgical year, see all four. Why do we have four faces of Christ? Why? Why four, not five? Why not three? Why four? Because he is the desire of the everlasting hills, if you read that book. He meets the deepest yearnings of our hearts in these four areas. And that is why we have four Gospels. They would fit right on the matrix of those four. Affection, eros, friendship, and agape. Okay, so that is what we experience every time we go to Sunday Mass, Holy Communion. We do those three things. We get the Gospels. We get the transubstantiation rite, transformation rite, which we are drawn into. And we say the petitions of the Our Father. All four loves are engaged. It is amazing. Now, yes, I think. It satisfies the deepest yearnings of the human heart. And we must direct these yearnings to an object that will not fail us. This is the practicality of good religion. Or we get screwed up. We divert these to a company, to a spouse, to a drug, to a career, to you name it. And we think it will be fulfilling. And we get into a cycle that is called essentially an addictive cycle. We try to get more and more and we get less and less. And we run from the sense of emptiness. It's so important. By the way, just a little tip. You know, at the end of the day, what a really good practice is to do what is called the ledger of the day. An abbot told me this once. He says, you know, you do your examination of conscience at the end of the day or whatever, you're saying your prayers. And he said, draw a line down the middle of a little journal. He said, and list on, this is facing you, minus, plus. List on the minus side all the stuff during the day that was so difficult for you and you're struggling with and you regret, and perhaps sins, whatever. Just list them so you can contain them in some way and enumerate them. Then over on the positive side, list all the blessings of the day for which you are grateful. All the good things that you experience during the day until you get to one more than the negative. That's your requirement. Get one more than the negative. And then you thank God for all the blessings of the day that you've recalled. And you feel fulfilled by the day. Filled full. This is why people hit the refrigerator just before they go to bed. Or they watch TV because they feel empty at the end of the day. And the opposite of depression is gratitude. The opposite of depression is gratitude. Not whoopee, but gratitude. So when Paul says, give thanks always, that's exactly it. It's exactly good mental health. And so you read, you give thanks for all the blessings of the day, and you close the book and kiss the day goodbye, and you will fall asleep counting your blessings, as the song says. Isn't that wonderful? And so that's something I deal with a lot with people that are depressed. But, you know, they're in our country, Thomas Jefferson sort of set us up. You know, instead of life, liberty, and property, like John Locke said, he said, we have an inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if you pursue happiness directly, it evades you. If you get if you're happy because of doing a good job or helping someone out or whatever, that's happiness. But if you pursue it directly and lay claim to it, you're going to get into an addictive cycle with what you're pursuing. That's America, folks. That's our big problem. So, I know I've wandered a bit. Oh. Yes? Yeah.
So starting there, what is a healthy progression? I seem to have missed it.
No. What? Don't we all? No, you can go back and do a timeline and see your own development in the kind of people that you've fallen for. That's one. And you can understand, well, I was looking for such and such. And you can be understanding of yourself, number one. But you can get a little better as we get a little more mature. You can say, well, you know, if I think there needs to be the initial chemistry with someone, but also there needs to be checking it out. You need to vet the person and take a look at the history and see what, you know, if they're a good candidate or not or something like that. Meet the family, you know, visit the prison. or something like that. We sort of get amazed at, see, the meaning, so many women, so little time, so many men, so little time, is all about the inner part of us that gets articulated in our relationships that are erotic. That's for growth. To have the benefits of monogamy and committed monogamy, which is a pretty good thing, you know, we need to commit ourselves to that as well. But to understand that we're always going to be reactive to this. Always. And a lot of people confound the two. That's a lack of chastity. That's unfortunate. You know, we don't teach that anymore. Yes?
So what are the characteristics of a good match, a good marriage? One that is going to work, one that should be?
Fundamentally, the two people need to both have something greater than their conscious ego by reason of which they're willing to endure hardship. They need to have the capacity to undergo change and hardship and not be in it as long as it feels good or it's on their terms or, you know, that you're really wonderful, but, you know, you're everything I ever dreamed. And romantic love is quite selfish. And what we do in order to mature is in each one of these loves, and this was sort of a little later, but we can do it right now, we are required to withdraw our initial attribution to the love object, whether affection, but particularly eros, and also maybe with a friend that we really thought they would be something and then they disappoint us or whatever. And even with God, we have ideas and we have usually egocentric expectations. That's what we are born with. When we are born, we're little egocentric people. That is, a little child is cognitively egocentric. He cannot imagine what the chair looks like from any other perspective except his own until he's about 7 years old. When he gets about seven, he decenters and is able to imagine, there may be another way of looking at that, you know. And so we call that the age of reason. It was actually the age of decentering. You begin to fundamentally kind of take other people in considerations, and we consider people morally responsible when that starts happening. Okay, well, the great challenge for all of us is to overcome our egocentric expectations as we grow up. That's the big challenge. The trouble is, we don't know we're being egocentric. What we think is real is the given. Okay? And I meet you, and I like you, and you're the way you are, and of course I'm attributing all kinds of things to you because I don't know you completely. And we progress in our relationship, and bit by bit, I come to know you. And then you get really become a fully fledged person in my mind, and I don't know how I feel quite. And at that point, we have to rally with agape. That is a love for you and invincible benevolence and wanting you to be happy your way, not on my terms, in terms of just the way you need to live your life. Now, the trick is, how do we put two lives together doing that? That's a trick. The hard part about withdrawing projection. See, projection is our idealized expectations about life, how it's going to be in terms of caretaking, relationship, power, and meaning. We have a belief that life's going to be a certain way. What we run into, and this is Richard Rohr talking, I mean, he's constantly telling us this, is that it's not about you. It's not on your terms. In fact, when you suffer major disillusionment, that's an opportunity for growth. You know, it's like Elijah in the cave. God is manifested not in the great deeds of power of earthquake and fire and wind like it was on Mount Sinai when the law was given in the first half of your life. See, Moses is the first half of your life. Elijah is the second. And Elijah's sitting there in the cave and he needs a vision of God because he is totally bummed. He has tried his best, and he just hadn't made it. He's been totally exposed. Jezebel's going to kill him. So, tell you what, and he's sitting in the back of the cave, and the voice of God comes after he's fled for his life. All the people just dropped him. You know, later, they're gone. You know, oh, great. You know, here he is on his own, sitting in the back of the cave, and the word comes, Elijah, why are you here? He says, you really want to know? Does his best Jack Nicholson for about two paragraphs. Everybody's gone. Great God you are. Nobody cares. You know, da, 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 da. Two paragraphs later, the voice says, are you done? Yes. All right, Elijah. Come to the front of the cave. I will be passing by. Remember the parallelism. This is very, very important about things just don't go right. Our body gives out. Our relationships go south. The kids don't turn out right. We did everything we knew. Why didn't they turn out right? What happened? My job. I got cut. I was doing everything right. They just cut the whole division out. You know, da, 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 da. And I don't even know about God anymore. I mean, the ideas I used to have, I just feel like I don't know if I believe like I used to. And there we are. And it seems like it's all been torn away. You see, our idea of God is not God. That's just our idea of God. That's the dark night of the soul. Our idea of life is not life. Our idea of God's love for us and care for us is not God's care for us and love for us. And so Elijah has gone through this royally, and he's got to go to the front of the cave. Moses got in the cleft of the rock when he got the tablets, and he was almost fried watching God. He glowed in the dark after that. So Elijah's in the cave. So this is real parallelism. And it says there's an earthquake, there's a fire, there's a wind. The Lord is not in any of those, but in a tiny whispering voice. A Hebrew scholar told me that also could be translated as absolute stillness. Nada, nada, nada. Meaning, it's in the deconstructive moments of our life, particularly when we are older, that we find the presence of God. Those are holy moments when it is precisely not on our terms. There, that's where God is. And that's our chance. That's where we just open up to God and to God's presence. And Elijah covers his face and goes to the front of the cave. And he gets a vision and he goes back and he deals with Jezebel and he has a successor. He does legacy. He gets Elijah. But it's a magnificent tale and it's about every single one of us. In the second half of life. Okay, so when it's not on our terms, we need to have prudence, temperance, fortitude, and justice to help us. We need to exercise the virtues of simplicity, fidelity, and service to help us direct our love properly in the big time areas of money, sex, and power. And still, we're going to feel stripped down when we get to the end of it all. And even, I don't know if you've ever gone through a period where your ideas of God just get totally stripped away. And you're going, I argue with God about God's existence. You get the logical flaw in that. But, I mean, it's like, where are you? What? You know? And so, God's really there. Okay, because God's principal attribute is presence. That's the one thing we know, biblically, of everything else. God is there. God doesn't go away. We have our ideas stripped, and we don't know how to stay present to God with our ideas having been stripped away. We don't know how to, so we just stand in it, and stand in the silence, and stand in the emptiness. Whew, hard to do. And very holy stuff. Okay? So, just a couple more things in terms of your handouts. See the last two pages of the big handouts. One says benchmark experience, and the other one's called Five Things My Spouse Does Which Please Me. Okay, pardon the spouse, but if you're not married, it just means my significant other, or the person that I'm really interested in. You can use this exercise for that as well, certainly. This one over here called the benchmark experience is, how have we had joy in our life and had remarkably good experiences? We've had some. Can we go back over time and find and analyze those? This is Richard Bowles' method in What Color Is Your Parachute? Okay? But it's on a single page, and you don't need to go to Sedona to do it. Okay? Saves you about $2,000. Just do what's on the page. Okay? Photocopy this page, make several copies of it, and then go back and look over your life to find out, this is about activities, this is about friendship. What were the real peak experiences in your life? What did you really enjoy? What was fun? I have people do this, you know, 40 plus, and they go back. It doesn't have to be work. It can be anything. It could be a vacation you had. It could be a trip. It could be a relationship. Go back and put a title to the experience, any experience you rediscover. Then unpack the experience in four categories: physical environment, social environment, activity, and reward. Meaning, where was I? Inside, outside, day, night, hot, cold. What was it? What made it? What were the particulars that made it such a good experience? Sometimes the physical environment means a great deal. Had a guy got a promotion, he was depressed. He did this, he says, I was outside for all my good experiences. I've been promoted to an interior office. I can't see the outside. I'm depressed. He got huge posters he put in his office. Forest, beach, really helped him. Really helped. He says, it was below threshold of awareness. Second, what kind of people were you with when you had your really cool experiences? That makes a difference. Third, what were you doing? Activity, organizing, persuading, singing, surfboarding, whatever. What were you doing? Participle. That was in the zone. That's called the zone, flow, where you lose track of time, you don't get tired, you're creative. I'm really interested in that. And the fourth is reward. What rewarded you about the experience? See if you can unpack the experience in these four categories. Just write down. Put that to the side, take the next remembered experience on your timeline, and fill a sheet out on that. Get about 10 experiences. Line them up next to each other and go across experiences, but in the same category, physical environment, physical environment, physical environment, and you will see consistencies. Have an 11th page that's blank and write down consistencies of physical environment I got to have. Then, interactive or social environment. What kind of people do I need to be around? Activity. What do I need to do? What do I do anyway? No matter what they call my job, I wind up doing that if I can. Oh, might as well admit it. I do that. I do that. And then finally, what really rewards me? Money is usually way down the list. But what really rewards me? I get that sheet of summary of the optimizers in those top experiences, and I use these to actively build my life. I take responsibility to try to build these into my life, because this is where God broke through into my life with joy. And I try to take responsibility for building my life that way. That is a way to become your own parent in some sense. You can look back to a retrospective of optimizers, and you take responsibility for making that an active set of ideas to build your life. That is how vocational counselors work with people at midlife. That was free. That's good stuff. Oh, boy. Does that make sense? That's cool, isn't it? I once worked with an Episcopal church that was building a new building. They were having a building campaign. It was a vestry. And the vestry said, "Oh, we don't know how to pitch this, you know." I said, "Okay, everybody, I want you to write the best experience you've ever had at the church here. Just do one. We have multiple people, one experience each. Before we had one person, multiple experiences. Now we have multiple people, one experience. So I want you to write the best experience you've had at St. David's. It, whatever. Where were you? Who were you with? What were you doing? What was the reward?" Everybody in the vestry did this. And we sat together, and after some prayer, everybody shared their best experience, about 5 minutes a person. About the sixth person, they started looking at each other saying, "That's what we do. That's who we are." A lot of it was liturgical. A whole lot of it had to do with prayer. They said, "That's why we ask for a new building. This is who we are. This is why we ask. Now we can ask for money." Isn't that amazing? So they found out who they were by reason of how God had touched them in their lives, in their church community. They needed to do this. That had to do with friendship. Friendship. This is a wonderful way to do this. And the last one, friendship. When I see couples that come in to see me, a lot of times they're pretty discouraged. They're not coming in because they're stupid. They're coming in because they're discouraged. And they tried their very best to make a relationship work and it hasn't worked. And so I say, and just, you don't have to do this, just take a look at it. It says, five things my significant other, my spouse does, which please me. Okay, I say, I give each of them this page. I said, I want you to write down five things they do that please you. Don't show it to your significant other. So they write down the five things. And then I say, now, say to her, I said, I'd like you to share with him the five things that you wrote. But before you share it, I want him to guess what you wrote. And he gets $1 for every one right. Put on a poker face. And the guy starts guessing what it is that he does that pleases her, that she's written down. Watch what happens. He starts saying, "Well, I get her coffee, you know, and I guess I play with the kids." And he gets about three and he goes, "I have no idea, because by the time they get into my office, they are so busy defending themselves against anticipated criticism in their relationship, they've forgotten to delight in anticipating that they're going to please their spouse. They don't rehearse that anymore. And so we got to get those muscles going again." So I said, "Look, you win $1 for everyone, right? She's paying. Come on, you only got three. Let's do four and five. This gets fun." "Oh, okay. I work hard. I try to, you know, help out, you know." And fifth, "Okay, I change the oil in the car." So, you know. Oh, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised. I mean, it's pretty basic. But you see how impoverished the man's thinking is by this time. That is the symptom of, you know, this going at and defaulting to, "I've got to protect myself from criticism." And then she reads. I say, "Okay, would you please read to him the five things you wrote, and after each one, why it pleases you?" And she starts reading it. And even if the guy didn't guess correctly, he wins big. He hears what he's doing right. Oh, my goodness. And then we get done, and you say, "Okay, you won $2, you know. I feel like Pat Sajak. Now, over here, I want him to tell you what he wrote, but you guess what he wrote before he shares." And she has to guess what she's doing right, or what he notices. Not what she hopes he would write, but what he actually wrote, which is different. And it's very, very interesting. It's all positive. See, and when they get done, they go, "Oh, man, that was really interesting." I say, "Okay, now what I'd like you to do in the next week is expand the list from 5 to 10. You do 6 to 10 by observing your spouse. So you've got to be under the watchful eye of an admiring spouse for a week." "Oh, no, not that. You know, enduring being viewed for what you do right." And so they're writing it down. And then redo the exercise. I'll tell you my 6 through 10 before I do. You got to guess what they are. You get $1 for everyone right. They do this at home. What that does is build up the muscles again of anticipating a positive reaction from their significant other. That's the thing that's missing. That's what's missing. They've defaulted to protecting themselves from criticism. And we gotta change that. Okay? Thought you might like to know that little exercise. It's nice. Okay? Which brings us to the grand finale. We're almost done. We started 5 minutes late. Is that okay? All right. We've gone through attachment and erotic attraction and friendship, shared activity, what we do together. But then it leads to this divine love. And you see, we were created in the image of God. In God's image, He created them. Male and female, He created them in God's image. Well, what is God? And then we read later on, God is love. But what kind of love? God's love is so remarkably inclusive and present to everyone and everything, I'd offer, that we just contemplated. It's just amazing. And see, we are prepared in these four loves to start directing our deepest yearnings for security and caretaking to our Heavenly Father, who will never fail to take care of us, and to direct our yearnings for a perfect soulmate who loves us deeply and suffers and agonizes with us and will go through transformation with us and resurrection in Jesus Christ, in God the Son. And we direct the deepest yearnings we have for perfect action and perfect effectiveness. We get that with the Holy Spirit, who in inspiring us as individuals and in community, we do things, as Jesus said, greater things than He did, we do as a community. And then we experience the love of the triune God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, inside us, indwelling in us. We are the temples of God. Human beings are. Not this wonderful facility. This is the building. You are the temple. The temple is the residence of the deity. Sacrifices offered on the steps of the temple to Apollo, to Yahweh. The temple is where there was contact made with the deity on earth. And Paul says, do you not know that you are the temple of the Holy Spirit? You are where contact is made with God on earth. It's in humans now. And I would offer that we each have a particular gift that we bring into this contact with each other. You see, when we bring the face of Christ that meets the deepest yearnings for security, we bring the Gospel of Matthew. Those of you that score SJ with your sense of responsibility and care for the less fortunate, I was hungry and you fed me, I was thirsty and you gave me to drink. They really do that, folks. You, SJs, are Matthew. Gospels are not words on paper. Gospels are people. NFs, you have particular gifts in the exchanges of people in relationships, in sexual relationships, in close and transformative relationships. Special gifts. This is Luke. Luke balances male and female in his Gospels. He depicts people. He's an artist. He talks about transformative parables, like the parable of the prodigal son, the parable of the good Samaritan. Transformation. That's what this kind of love is about. And Luke, you are still with us. You are Luke, NFs. And then we have Mark. Mark, who gives us courage. In Mark, the shortest of the Gospels, Jesus shows us how to die and how to live out our vocation with immense courage and, I'd say, political skill. And he dies. And the women go to the tomb. It's empty. And they run away and they don't tell anybody. The end. Can you handle it? Huh? Bam! That's Mark. SPs, you're Mark. I never want to play one-on-one basketball with you. You'll win. You know, they're very good at that. And then finally, and now for something completely different. And the people that score NT are showing us the face of Jesus that we see in John, where Jesus talks about truth and love and gives us a perspective on the divine that we don't have any other way. And those of you that are NTs, you are the bridge points for eternity, for our community. You see, we need all of you because we need all four to become a complete human being. But one tends to be a rap for our conscious motivational style, and one tends to be a gospel that we enact. And so I'd ask you, go read your gospel and let it saturate into you and realize that that is your gift to the community. And all of the gospels in combination are leading us to the summary of the four loves, which is the eternal love of the Trinitarian God toward which we are heading, because this is rehearsal. And we're heading toward that. Thank you very much. Okay. I'll stick around if you got questions and all that, but I know you probably want to go to the brownies or do something constructive like that. Any comments, questions? The thing that I want you also to remember is when you go to Sunday morning, remember the four Gospels, the fourfold shape of the structure of the Eucharist, and the four petitions of the Our Father. And those things tick off those deep needs and activate those four loves in our heart. And get a copy of The Four Loves out there by C.S. Lewis to run into a first-rate writer who's a wonderful Christian who elaborates on each one of those and will probably improve all of our English if we read it. So thank you very much. Yay.